Good morning. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'll let the people in the back come in. Before I begin, I'd kind of like to get a sense of my audience. How many of you are third to sixth grade teachers? And 7th through 12th? All the elementary teachers are in the front, and all of you secondary are in the back. K through 2? Admins? Parents? Excellent. Well, welcome to the workshop on awakening moral imagination through fairy tales. It's Saturday morning. Hopefully you have some coffee with you. Thank you for coming to this workshop and joining the brotherhood of and sisterhood of fairy tale lovers. We few, we happy few, we fairy tale lovers. Today, I have much to say about fairy tales, more than I could fit in an hour. And chances are, I'm going to say some things that are going to make you want to say some things back to me. So I'm going to say, try to save 10 minutes for questions at the end. A few comments. Take notes. Do whatever it takes for you to stay awake. But at the end, I will give you a web address where you can get a complete text of my talk. This is something I think is very important. The re-engagement of the imagination and education, and I want to make it available to you. One last caveat, and I tell my students never to bias their audience in rhetoric, but as I was prepping this, I realized that most of my examples from the fairy tales are from fairly recent fairy tales, Lewis and Tolkien, Peter Pan, George MacDonald. That's mostly because I was reading all of these books to my kids while I was writing this, and so all of this still applies to Hans Christian Andersen and the Brothers Grimm, with modifications. Okay. We'll begin with some philosophical discourse on moral imagination and why it's important and how it functions. Then we'll move to a very practical nuts and bolts application of this at the end. I'll give you some specific advice for teaching fairy tales and literature in general. And then we'll take a look at Pinocchio and The Hobbit. So let's begin as good classical teachers by defining our terms. What exactly do we mean by the moral imagination, awakening, and fairy tales? Imagination is, of course, our image-making faculty, the human faculty that allows us to envision what is not immediately present to the senses. Imagination allows us to perceive possibilities, potentialities, how things could be, or more specific to our purposes, how things should be. Seeing the world in terms of how it should be involves the moral imagination. In the realm of ethics, the moral imagination is absolutely essential, for it allows us to transfer abstract ethical concepts into practical everyday living, to envision practical applications, and especially to relate to the suffering and trials of another person. Empathy, for instance, requires imagination, to put ourselves in another's situation. Love also requires imagination. Paul writes that love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. How can love hope for the best for the beloved unless love can somehow imagine the beloved as other than he or she is? Hope and perseverance also both depend on the imagination, envisioning a world that could be different from the present reality. One of the best-known expositions of the moral imagination is in The Abolition of Man, in which C.S. Lewis argues that the development of moral imagination, or practical reason as he calls it, is a central goal in education. Young people must be taught to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things that really are pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful. According to Lewis, in order to have virtue, in order to develop proper moral responses to the world, one must first assume that there is an objective morality, that there is a set of responses that are proper. Then one must internalize this set of responses until they become second nature, until the responses come without much logical thought to prompt them. When young people have internalized these proper emotional responses to the external world, they have cultivated their moral imagination. The faculty of proper emotional and ethical responses to the external world. A properly trained moral imagination allows us to have proper emotional responses to a situation and to act in the proper way in that situation. Hopefully you can see how this ties to wisdom in the Hebrew sense, which the art of living skillfully, of knowing and doing what is right. Moral philosophers have long expressed the vital connection between imagination and morality. In his book on moral imagination, Vigen Guarian explains that the moral imagination is not a thing, not even so much a faculty, as the very process by which the self makes metaphors out of images given by experience and then employs these metaphors to find and suppose moral correspondences in experience. The moral imagination is the process, then, by which we draw analogies from an imaginary world, from the world as it should be, with the world as it actually is. These analogies and metaphors then help us know how to act in particular situations. Like other faculties and skills, we can strengthen our moral imaginations or those of our students through nurture and exercise. And one of the chief ways of doing this is through imaginative literature. Reading stories and poems gives us a vast library of symbolic information about the shape and moral fabric of our world. As Alasdair MacIntyre asserts, it is through hearing about wicked stepmothers, lost children, good but misguided kings, wolves that suckle twin boys, youngest sons who receive no inheritance but must make their own way in the world, and eldest sons who waste their inheritance, that children learn or mislearn what a child or what a parent is, what the cast of characters may be in the drama into which they have been born, and what the ways of the world are. Deprive children of stories, and you leave them unscripted, anxious stutterers in their actions as in their words. Stories teach us the texture of reality. They help us position ourselves in our proper place and enable us to pick the right side. They give us a lifetime of vicarious experience to help us see the world as it really is. When children have a catalog of good stories in their heads and hearts, they have a reference point, a script, which helps them know how to act virtuously in their own stories. There's a lot more to be said about moral imagination, but for now, let us define the moral imagination as the ability to discern a righteous response in any given situation. So why must this faculty be awakened? Well, anyone who has ever had recess duty can give an immediate answer to this. Okay? The moral imagination must be awakened because in Adam's fall, we sinned all. Righteousness is not a natural condition of human beings, even of those who have been regenerated by the Holy Spirit. Training in righteousness requires training, education, sanctification. But to awaken implies that something is sleeping. So in what sense is the student's moral imagination asleep? Well, Jesus taught us that where our treasure is, there our heart is also. Love motivates all of our actions. When we love God properly, our actions are aligned toward Christ. When we love something in place of God, our actions are warped or bent, as Lewis would put it. All of us, including our students, have deep loves that motivate all of our actions. In fact, Dante argues that all of our actions are motivated by love itself, love for proper things or love for improper things. The true purpose of education, then, is to orient these loves, the loves of our students, toward their proper objects, to order the student's loves so that he feels the right type and degree of love for each thing. With properly ordered loves, the student will be able to respond to the world in the proper way. He will have a fully awakened moral imagination. So how do we awaken love? How do we orient a young man's love for the proper things? For C.S. Lewis, this happened through a fairy tale. As a young man, Lewis had abandoned the Christianity of his youth for an atheistic rationalism. He had a deterministic vision of the world, believing it to be governed by chemical and mechanical forces. and trusting that mankind, that reason was mankind's only sure guide in the world. But one day on a train ride, he happened to pick up a copy of George MacDonald's Fantasties, right? One of George MacDonald's longest fairy tales. And as he was riding on the train, he found himself suddenly transformed by the story. "What it did to me," said Lewis, "was to convert, even baptize, my imagination." The fairy tale challenged his reductive, deterministic rationalism with an imaginary vision of the world as a place where love and beauty were far more important than chemistry and genes, where the world was not a machine, but a gift. See how those are two different stories of the world. Though the story was about fairyland, Lewis realized that he had become enchanted not with another world, but with the quality of the real universe, he wrote, the divine, magical, terrifying, and ecstatic reality in which we all live. What I learned to love in Fantasties was goodness. Lewis explains why this happened by describing how a fairy story affects its reader. He writes, "A fairy story goes beyond the expression of things we have already felt. It arouses in us sensations we have never had before, never anticipated having, as though we had broken out of our normal mode of consciousness and possessed joys not promised to our birth. It gets under our skin, hits us at a level deeper than our thoughts or even our passions, troubles oldest certainties till all questions are reopened, and in general shocks us more fully awake than we are for most of our lives." This sounds promising, doesn't it, as educators? Notice how Lewis's comments bring together things that we've talked about so far regarding the moral imagination. The beauty of fairy tales awakens our love for goodness by baptizing our imagination. A fairy story awakened Lewis's love for goodness. Eventually, fairy tales and myths and imagination even led to Lewis's conversion to Christianity. And so let us take a closer look at what makes fairy stories so well suited for this awakening of the moral imagination. What is a fairy tale? Every fairy tale has two essential characteristics. First, a journey to an unusual place that is at once strange and yet familiar. This place is unsought by the hero and reached by accident or without the hero's conscious knowledge. In these fairy stories, you can't go seeking fairyland. Okay? Secondly, after his or her adventures in this unusual place, the hero returns home and is clearly the better for the journey. This is the central purpose of the story, sanctification, to make the hero a better person. Though many types of stories involve journeys, only fairy tales take the heroes to the world of fairy, an odd, enchanting, dangerous land, at once completely foreign and hauntingly familiar. Fairy is also called the perilous realm because it is simultaneously achingly sublime and terrifyingly deadly. It can be bewitching. It has beauty and danger in the same degree, and the hero often finds both just around the bend. Fairy can also take many shapes and names: Narnia, Middle-earth, Terabithia, Neverland, Wonderland, Lowgrace, the Wild Wood, Camelot. Regardless of the name, however, fairy stories always involve protagonists who are profoundly ordinary, often uncomfortably, familiarly like us. And almost without exception, these ordinary heroes find their way into fairy by accident. They wander into it, sometimes literally stumbling, sometimes awaking to find their bedroom transformed into a forest, their sink turning into a spring. Someone or something has brought them there very much without their permission, and that something or somewhere has the audacity to be nowhere around to explain his actions. The protagonists find themselves without instruction or guide or purpose in a strange land, and they have no choice but to choose a promising direction and start walking. Almost immediately, something happens to our hero, something that involves a decision, a moral response. The hero finds himself facing the impossible task. either have to complete some overwhelmingly difficult task or some ridiculously arbitrary command. And we know how the story goes, right? The hero inevitably fails. He proves to be too ordinarily human, his moral imagination underdeveloped, and so darkness falls. Despite the failure, however, help always comes from some source beyond the hero. Aslan arrives. The eagles appear over Mount Doom. The old woman is actually wisdom incarnate. Mole trips over Badger's door scraper. In the darkest moment, a light appears, a grace at the zero point. But this help, this is important, this help does not perform the task or obedience for the hero. The unexpected help gives the hero just enough grace so that he can accomplish the task or obey the command. The Chronicles of Narnia and the Lord of the Rings are filled with examples of this. Aslan's face appears in a book of spells just before Lucy falls to the temptation of Eve's pride, but Lucy still has to decide to close the book herself and complete her task. The hobbits repeatedly find hospitality just as the dark of doom falls, as when the elves of Lothlorien deliver them from the pursuing orcs. Yet the hobbits must journey on to Mount Doom themselves. The elves aid them with important gifts, but cannot take the task away from them. This is vital for the purpose of fairy tales. The hero can grow in virtue and character only by completing the task or obeying the command. Character comes in the persevering through trials. Virtue is developed in that terrible moment when we must choose to do the right thing, come what may. Eventually, the task is passed, though often at some cost to the hero, and he or she has become wiser, braver, and kinder. Moral imagination has been fully awakened, and the hero returns home equipped to live in a world where the monsters and dangers aren't always so obvious. His laughter is richer, his love stronger, and his life more vital. So it is with the great Samwise Gamgee when he returns to his beloved Shire. He is the same old Sam, but there is a rich, loamy strength in him. The vitality and resilience of green things has become part of his soul. A fairy story must end with the hero coming home and seeing his own world with new eyes and a greater love. According to C.S. Lewis, this is an essential attribute of fairy stories. The reader of a fairy tale, Lewis writes, does not despise real woods because he has read of enchanted woods. The reading makes all real woods a little enchanted. And when love for this world is awakened, the reader's moral imagination will also be awakened. For the things we love, we take care of, we protect and cultivate. By passing vicariously through fairyland with the hero, the reader undergoes the same moral development as the protagonist and closes the book, hopefully, a more virtuous person. A few months ago, I started reading Peter Pan to my kids. And I couldn't have scripted this better for this talk. Before we were 5 pages into the story, my son asked the inevitable question, "Is Neverland real?" I took a deep breath. I knew how much was riding on this question and how I answered it. And so I said, I looked right into his eyes and I said, "You bet it is." "Of course Neverland is a real place," I told my son. "Wendy, John, and Michael are going to spend a long time there, and we wouldn't have a book to read if Neverland didn't exist." And this only encouraged the next question, "Can we go there?" And just as confidently, I said, "We're going there right now. We're going to, if we can stay awake till chapter 4." Right? We were going there in our imaginations. Right? Kids are great, right? You can read all the books about, you know, philosophy and moral imagination, but just have a kid and try to answer some of their questions. In his brilliant essay on fairy stories, required reading for anyone who wants to get to the heart of this stuff, J.R.R. Tolkien explains how the writer of fairy tales must invent an imaginary world for his hero to have adventures in. Because this world must be simultaneously recognizable and foreign to the reader, the author has to create his new world very much along the lines of our own world. For this reason, Tolkien called such authors sub-creators, since their act of creation so closely imitated the creator. On our first visit to Narnia, Neverland, and Middle-earth, everything seems to have been made ex nihilo, but the more time we spend there, the more recognizable and familiar everything seems, the more these other worlds remind us of home. For Tolkien, sub-creation is a fundamental human activity and essential to the Imago Dei. Each act of human creation draws from the materials of God's original work of creation, and so every act of human making testifies to the Creator. Even fallen and rebellious human creativity both depends on and witnesses to the God who made everything. As Tolkien explains in his poem Mythopoeia, "Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned, his world dominion by creative act, not his to worship the great artifact. Man, sub-creator, the refracted light, through whom is splintered from a single white to many hues and endlessly combined in living shapes that move from mind to mind." Notice the metaphor here. The sub-creator, which in Tolkien's definition is any human making, functions like a prism, refracting the white light of primary creation in order to make visible all the various hues of God's created beauty. The beauty of secondary creation, of the books and the art that we love so much, is simply a making manifest of the latent beauties in creation, in primary creation. George MacDonald voiced a similar view regarding fairy tales. Right? He also believed that they reflected this latent beauty. He compared them, instead of a prism, to a looking glass that helps us see the hidden beauty of our primary creation. In Fantastes, which you all should read tonight if you haven't already, George MacDonald explains that an ordinary room or plain face can somehow become enchanted and lovely when reflected in a mirror. The reflected room is very familiar, sometimes to the point where we don't give it any attention at all. The actual room is very familiar, and we tend to not think of it or look at it or consider its actual beauty. But when we see it reflected in a mirror, when we see it transposed, it becomes familiar and yet foreign enough to draw our attention to it. This shift in perspective causes us to study the reflection, attempting to discover what it is that's alluring us to it, what creates the strangeness, the beauty in the reflection. And when we finally turn away from the mirror, and this is the whole point, when we turn away from that mirror, we look at the room itself and we see it in different ways. We begin looking for its latent, unrefracted beauty. Okay? So George MacDonald would argue that when we look at fairy tales, they cause us to come back to the world and to see it with new eyes. Our eyes have been opened and we begin to love the old, familiar, and ordinary in a deeper way. As secondary worlds, fairyland is built upon the materials of our primary world. They are reflections, as George MacDonald pointed out, or refractions, if you wish. Fairyland enchants us so readily because the world it presents is so familiar that we feel like we belong to it, that we have a right to enter it. Yet fairy worlds are immediately strange as well. Their very setting engages our curiosity and makes us want to enter. And once we enter, we realize that beauty and wonder and love are dripping off the trees, sometimes literally. Beauty teaches us the truth about how the world is, awakening our love and desire to imitate the goodness we see in fairyland. By amplifying beauty and ugliness, good and evil, authors of fairy tales help us see the realities of our own world with clearer eyes. Fairy tales function like the clever light in a master painting or photograph. By drawing our attention to overlooked details, we see them anew. We see them as they always are, but not as we usually see them. As Lewis put it, stories can set before us an image of what reality may well be like at some more central region. Thus, we fall in love with Narnia and Neverland, Middle-earth and Fairyland, because they have taught us about our own true home. When we put down the fairy tale, our lives will have greater joy and nobility, having realized that Narnia is only earth in microcosm. Middle-earth is only one side of true earth. Paralandra is possible only because of our very terrestrial telos. This transformative power of fairy stories is essential to our discussion. If fairy stories can change us by the mere reading of them, if we're receptive to their work, if they can awaken love and wonder for the primary world, then they can also awaken the moral imagination. By arousing a greater attention to the world, fairy stories also cause our students to have a greater care for the world. And the greater care they have for the world and the people in it, the greater care they will have for the God who made it. This is the goal of all classical Christian education, to turn the hearts and loves of our students to Christ, their Creator. Or as Lewis would put it, to give them chests to unite their reason and desire in virtuous emotions and actions. In short, to make them truly human after the image of Christ. To put all of these ideas together, let's look briefly at a poem by George Herbert, a 17th century poet-priest. In his poem, The Elixir, Herbert begins with a very simple prayer. Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, and what I do in anything to do it as for thee. A straightforward prayer for every Christian, right? To see God in everything we do and to have everything we do reflect or give glory to God. But later in the poem, Herbert states that this is actually quite possible, to really see God in everything. He writes, a man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth, through it pass, and then the heaven espy. When we look in the glass of a window, especially the imperfect, wobbly glass of the 17th century, we can choose to see either our reflection in the glass in the window, or what lies beyond the window. We can use the glass as either a mirror or a window. Or better yet, Herbert argues, we can use it as both, choosing to have our eyes see both the goodness and beauty of God's creation, as well as seeing in the created object the goodness and beauty of the Creator. Okay? See that double vision? Okay. This double vision allows us to see the world rightly. As Herbert puts it, this type of vision is the famous stone that turneth all to gold. It turns drudgery divine, the beggar, into a brother. This vision is essential for a fully functional moral imagination, for righteousness. It's what allows our students to see that the world really is all gift, to see the world as God, the Creator, Giver, sees it. Without this vision, we cannot see the world or our neighbor rightly, and therefore we cannot love or act as we should. Since fairy tales function as mirror windows and teach us how to love our world more truly, they are a helpful tool in cultivating this double vision. Malcolm Gait, another contemporary poet-priest, recently explained the purpose of poetry in terms familiar to our discussion. He writes, to hear snatches from the huge, unknowable symphony of experience, to catch them and transpose them into a key that resonates with our understanding so that at some point they harmonize with that unheard melody from heaven we are always trying to hear. That is the purpose of poetry. It is also the purpose, to some degree, of fairy story, and we would do well to make ourselves and our students much more familiar with them. Fairy tales are mirrors by which we see our world truly, windows that reveal heaven, and transposed symphonies that make the music of the spheres audible to our fallen ears. And so I answered my son by telling him that Neverland is a very real place. Neverland is our world. All its zany frolicking and boisterous irreverence to some degree points to the true joy of innocence. The courage and sacrifice of Middle Earth is actually the nobility of earthly mothers who raise kids alone, of those who labor faithfully at thankless jobs, of those who serve the ungrateful, and those who fight against injustice with their very lives. The clarity and goodness of Narnia are the natural results of a life lived in peace with God, with Aslan. Before discussing some actual fairy tales, which I know you're all eager to get to, we must address another common and misguided objection to fairy tales, an objection often extended to any kind of imaginative literature. Talk about the importance of fairy tales to almost anyone in our modern world, and you are almost certain to hear your arguments rebutted with a charge of escapism. Encouraging young people to read fairy tales is encouraging them to disengage with the world, to ignore its problems by fleeing to some alternate reality. Hopefully, the first part of this talk has already defined for you the beginning of a response. The true purpose of fairy tales isn't to escape from primary creation, but to engage with it more fully. But there's more to be said about the charge of escapism. Escapism is a real sin and a real temptation. Escapism is a refusal to obey God's commands to rule the earth and subdue it, to have your work in this world manifest Christ's lordship. Escapism is to love shadows more than substance, symbols more than significance, to love the art and scorn the reality. But the way we can strengthen our students' resistance to escapism is not by keeping them from fairy tales, but by giving them piles of fairy tales to read, and piles of poetry, novels, plays, and every other kind of imaginative literature. Let me explain. Modernism, ominous, modernism. The reigning vision of the world for the last three centuries has been one of reductive materialism, a purely rational assertion that everything around us, including ourselves, consists of nothing but atoms pinging off each other. There is nothing transcendent or supernatural, and therefore there is no ultimate meaning or purpose in the world. Humans have no ultimate calling, but must create their own reason for being. Anything that the ancients or the medievals believed to be ennobling, virtue, reason, art, freedom of will, artistic talent, simply respond from genes expressing themselves variously. In an attempt to classify and order the world solely through human reason, apart from revelation, modernism flattened the many-splendored world into a deterministic machine driven by the irrefutable cogs of genetics and chemical reactions. Modernism dismissed as irrelevant and unreliable much that makes humans human. And unfortunately, the church has bought into much of the modern reductionism. The problem with modernism is not its complete dependence on genetics and chemistry and human reason, all of which are true and good and beautiful and an important part of God's primary creation. The problem with modernism is the story that it tells of the world. Modernism's story is that mankind is not a subcreator, not the steward of creation, to some degree not even an organism. He is merely a set of mechanistic responses to his environment. One of the unifying themes in Tolkien's and Lewis's writings is their militant stand against modernism, modern reductionism. They believe that their tasks as writers was to craft new myths for the modern world, new paradigmatic stories that embodied an older, more human vision of the world. These new myths were aimed at the imagination of their readers, for Lewis and Tolkien knew that by stirring up the imagination, wonder and love are awakened. And once the beauty-hungering heart awoke, it would melt the frozen mind and will. For Lewis and Tolkien and many thinkers after them, the antidote to modernism is partly through imaginative literature, especially myth and fairy tale. And again, remember Mr. Wilson's definition of myth previously. By re-engaging the imagination and integrating it once again with reason, fairy tales create a harmony of faculties in their readers. They are the keys to the dungeon of giant modernism. For this reason, Tolkien sang poetic praise of those who wrote such stories. Blessed are the legend makers with their rhyme of things not found within recorded time. They have seen death and ultimate defeat, and yet they would not in despair retreat, but oft to victory have turned the lyre and kindled hearts with legendary fire, illuminating now when dark hath been with light of suns as yet by no man seen. By reading and rereading fairy tales, we take up arms against the slings and arrows of an outrageous worldview. We fight against the principalities and powers of this present darkness. And so, far from escaping from the primary world, fairy tales allow us to escape from a modern myth of the world. Fairy tales proclaim that the world is full of love and wonder and beauty, that there is mystery and divinity, that humans are capable of ennobling acts of sacrifice and courage, of wisdom and grace. Fairy tales tell us that all the world is a gift. Writing about this very topic, C.S. Lewis said that The Wind in the Willows seems at first the grossest kind of escapism. The characters are as carefree as children, but as free to order their lives as adults. But instead of sending us back to our ordinary world, our ordinary lives discontented, we find when we finish The Wind in the Willows that it has given us a great desire to enjoy the simplest pleasures of life. Food, sleep, exercise, friendship, the face of nature, even in a sense religion. And in this same way, the whole story, paradoxically enough, strengthens our relish for real life. This excursion into the preposterous sends us back with renewed pleasure into the actual. Fairy tales do indeed encourage escaping, but it is an escape from the dirt and grit of a parking lot to the cool air of a mountain meadow, from a hovel to a castle, from mud puddles to a holiday at the beach. God has given us a world that is far bigger than we are, full of mystery and beauty, and through stories, we can take our students by the hand and say, look, love, and live in the freedom and joy you were created for. Let's take a quick look at two actual fairy tales and consider how they can awaken the moral imagination. First, a few general comments on teaching fairy tales. And this really applies to all imaginative literature. First, don't just focus on meaning. There is so much more to a story than just the theme or message. In fact, the reason people write stories, especially fairy stories, is to communicate truths that cannot be communicated in other ways. In stories, as most of you know, meaning is conveyed through character, symbol, metaphor, motif, plot, pattern, and a myriad of other things. You don't need to explore all of these with your class, but look at some of them. If you focus only on meaning, you will be propagating the modern myth and teaching your students that a story can be reduced to a kernel of truth surrounded, that the story is just a kernel of truth surrounded by a lot of superfluous chaff. We've got to get rid of all that beauty to get to truth. Okay. If you do that, you will miss much of what is real and true in a story. Much of the truth in fairy tales can only be understood through the experience of reading the story rather than through discursive analysis. That's why we read novels instead of spark notes, right? Secondly, awaken wonder in your students. Read the story as much like a child as you can and discuss it as an object of wonder. In your discussions, spend time discussing your favorite parts, even if they aren't the most important parts. Maybe especially if they aren't the most important parts. Draw your students' attention to the story's beauty. Read aloud, especially the sections that are well written, and talk to them about why they're so attractive. Arouse the students' curiosity and delight. Pose dilemmas for them to solve. Change the details of the story and have them figure out what the characters would do in new situations. In short, give their imagination a kick in the pants. Number three, move toward application. The point of reading these stories is to allow them to work on you, to transform you. Show your students how this is done. In each discussion, move toward an answer to the question, what does this reading require of us? How do we need to change? What is attractive about this hero? What virtue does he or she convey that we are missing? And don't be afraid of simple answers to this question. If you've been faithful in drawing out what is true and beautiful in the story, you should have no problem in finding the story's goodness and discovering much about yourself that needs to change. Pinocchio, at last. We're all familiar with the story of Pinocchio in one form or another. Hopefully, you first met Pinocchio in Carlo Collodi's story instead of the Disney film, or worse yet, in Shrek. One of my good friends, he has a young friend that he reads to, he's five, and he's like, he thought ogres were good. It was a moral crisis for him. Regardless of the form, Pinocchio's story is about his search to become a real boy. The central theme in this story is an answer to a very important question. What does it mean to be human? This is a vital question for every human being to answer, and we shouldn't wait until the rhetoric school to have our students start wrestling with it. Pinocchio's desire to be a real boy implies that he is not yet a real boy. Pinocchio understands that he is not what he should be, and the central problem Pinocchio faces is the difficulty of being good, in becoming morally responsible. The original Pinocchio, Collodi's Pinocchio, is bad from the beginning, and his actions repeatedly bring suffering to others. Throughout the first part of the novel, woodenness is an apt metaphor for Pinocchio, since he is defined, as one author says, by a hard head, undisciplined passions, and a misdirected will that resists good advice. In fact, when the classical philosopher Cricket rebukes his selfishness and calls him to a more virtuous path, Pinocchio squashes him flat with one of Geppetto's mallets. Can you imagine if they'd put that in the Disney film? Jiminy! That's what happens, son. let me tell you about a man named Socrates. That's a whole other workshop. Children reading Collodi's Pinocchio if parents and teachers have been doing their work, they should remark how disobedient and mean Pinocchio is. Ooh, that's not good, right? And their teachers or parents at that point should gently tell them, show them, how much like Pinocchio they are, right? And how much like Pinocchio we are. This is the beginning of the moral imagination, to provide an image of wickedness that incarnates principles of righteousness and so make them tangible to children. Right? You tell your parents, you must obey your father and mother, right? That's absolutely true. But when they have an image of what disobedience looks like and how disobedience leads to pain and suffering for others, then they can look at that and analyze it as a metaphor that they can then apply to their own lives. When I'm mean to my sister, I'm doing what Pinocchio did to the blue fairy. When children grasp that they are indeed like Pinocchio, they can also begin wrestling with the fact that they are not what they should be. They know very well what the standard of obedience is in their home and school, yet they have a very difficult time measuring up to it, just as Pinocchio does. Again, parents and teachers can point out that we all have hard heads, undisciplined passions, and misdirected wills that resist wise counsel. We know the good that we should do, and often want to do, and which we so often fail to do. Secondly, from Pinocchio, grace and love are what change him. In Collodi's story, Pinocchio is actually hanged on a tree by assassins. There's lots of important symbolism and analogy there. But he's rescued and nursed back to health by the blue fairy, who functions much like an angel or a mediator. Here we see the necessary elements of fairy. Unexpected, unexplained help coming in the form of transformative grace. Sacramental grace that changes the hero and strengthens him for the task he has been given. The Blue Fairy revives Pinocchio and begins his moral instruction, and the central theme in her instruction is to help Pinocchio understand his proper relationship to his father, Geppetto. She teaches him to respect his parent and obey him. To be a fully grown man, she tells Pinocchio, begins with being a good boy. And so, in response to the grace, mercy, and love the Blue Fairy has shown him, Pinocchio seeks to live an obedient life. The answer to Pinocchio's question about being a real human is grace. That's the beginning of the answer, grace. Grace, unmerited, turns our hearts of stone, or wood in this case, into hearts of flesh, making obedience possible. God's grace makes our goodness possible. Because of the grace he has shown us, we are thankful, and we show our thankfulness through our obedience. For if we love Jesus, we will keep his commands. Pinocchio has a new heart, but he is still deeply flawed. Almost immediately, he is led away from the Blue Fairy and falls into terrible misfortunes. But the Blue Fairy appears to him again later in the story, and her instruction once again restores him. At this point in the story, Pinocchio learns that what makes him human is not being good. We're classical teachers, isn't that? Becoming human means being virtuous. Well, not it does, but not completely, right? What makes Pinocchio human is not being good, but being a son. It is his relationship to his father that defines his humanity. He is human because he has a father. This, of course, has obvious applications and a very vital one. Many, many Christians struggle to understand the scandalous love of God revealed in the gospel. God's favor makes us sons and daughters, not our goodness. We seek to be good because God has already shown us his love and favor. We are not good in order to earn God's favor. This is the central lesson in Collodi's Pinocchio, and the most vital lesson every young child must learn. The Hobbit is a straightforward fairy... How many of you have read The Hobbit? Thank goodness. The Hobbit is a straightforward fairy tale. It's a story of a homebody hobbit who reluctantly embarks on a journey, is given an impossible task, receives grace to help in time of need, completes his task, and returns home a greatly changed character. Okay. The difficulty with teaching or discussing Tolkien's works is that he consciously wrote myth and not allegory or analogy. This means that his stories have to be taken on as a whole, on their own terms, and not read as a symbol for something else. Tolkien's stories were solidly a secondary creation, and Tolkien expected his readers to enter fully into them without expecting to find the secret, to find an explicit, correct, symbolic connection to primary creation. However, because they are myth, Tolkien's stories have countless connections and applications to our world. The most obvious of these in The Hobbit is the nature of Bilbo's quest, a journey fraught with peril that ends with the slaying of a dragon, the rescue of a treasure, the deliverance of a people living under the shadow of a dragon. This is the same plotline as Spenser's story of St. George and the Dragon, of Beowulf. It is the very storyline of Scripture itself. This plotline should prepare us as readers from the beginning for a moral world, where good and evil are tangible and have far-reaching consequences. A great deal rests on individual decisions in such a world. The Elven King's suspicion and lack of charity nearly ends the entire quest. Thorin's greed almost starts a war with old allies. Bilbo's decision to take action against overwhelming odds, even without a plan, repeatedly saves the entire expedition. Likewise, our students need to know that they also live in a solidly moral world where good and evil have tangible, lasting effects. Sin always has consequences that reaches beyond the sinner. Much rests on all of our decisions. And all of our decisions, even the seemingly superfluous ones, all of our decisions involve choices between good and evil, obedience and disobedience. Secondly, the reason for the change that Bilbo undergoes is that he is left alone in a difficult situation with no one to bail him out, no one he can turn to. Gandalf sets an example of bravery and leadership at the beginning of the expedition, but then leaves them alone to wander through Mirkwood, which is the most dangerous part of their quest. And as we would expect, they very quickly ignore the council and wander off the path. Okay? The result is that Bilbo is separated from his companions. He falls asleep and he wakes up to find himself being attacked by a giant spider, and he's forced to defend himself and kill the spider, which suddenly changes him. Okay? Tolkien writes, "Somehow the killing of the giant spider, all alone by himself in the dark, without the help of the wizard or the dwarves or of anyone else, made a great difference to Mr. Baggins. He felt a different person, and much fiercer and bolder, in spite of an empty stomach, as he wiped his sword on the grass and put it back into his sheath." Indeed, Mr. Baggins is a bolder creature. He goes on not only to rescue his friends from a nest of giant spiders, but also from the Elven King's enchanted dungeon. He riddles with a dragon, always a dangerous job, prevents a war, and endures the wrath of a dwarf king in the grip of gold lust. In the same way, we can teach our students that character is developed by enduring difficulty, not by being rescued from it. For suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, Paul writes in Romans. Reading this episode in The Hobbit is a great opportunity to instruct our students about the proper response to trials and difficulties, and to exhort them to persevere by relying on the grace of God. Paul continues in Romans 5, "Because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us." I'll end our discussion of The Hobbit with this final point. When they finally return to the Shire, Bilbo and Gandalf stop at the top of a rise overlooking Bilbo's Hill. Bilbo suddenly bursts into poetry, a poem about walking roads that go on, and feet that finally come home. When he finishes, Gandalf declares, "My dear Bilbo, you are not the same hobbit you used to be." Bilbo has indeed been transformed into another being. He has been remade, reborn even, just as our moral imaginations have been when we finish the story. In fact, when he returns to the Shire, he learns that he is presumed deceased and his estate is being sold. For the other hobbits, the return of Bilbo Baggins is nothing less than a resurrection, perhaps the best metaphor to explain the change in his character. Let me conclude with one final assertion about the importance of fairy tales. When I explained to my son how Neverland and Narnia and Middle-earth were real, he went to bed very happy. The miracle he had hoped for had come true. His imaginary play had been made solid and tangible. He discovered that the imaginary worlds he loved were part of the world he actually lived in. He really could fight against evil and defend the helpless. He could be as brave and shrewd and loyal and wise as the characters he'd met in fairy tales. I went to bed that night equally joyful, for my son was well on his way to understanding the great story, the great fairy tale, that God himself became solid, took on flesh, died on a tree, and transformed the entire fallen world into the haunting land of fairy. I only have 6 minutes now for questions, so I want to get quickly to something. If you would like a text of this talk, you can get one here. It's not up yet. In fact, if you go there, you'll get an error message that you've violated the sacred shrine of the internet. But I will have this file posted there by the end of the week. Okay? Feel free to share it with whomever you like. Just, you know, don't plagiarize and stuff. If you have any questions, other questions that don't get answered in the next 5 minutes, you can contact me at any of those ways. Okay. Any questions? Fantasties by George MacDonald. Phantasties. When you download this document, there will be an extended bibliography that has that in there. Other questions? Saturday morning. Romans 5, 3 through 5. A question here in front. Okay. Good. I was hoping someone would ask this. The question was Cinderella and Snow White. There's witchcraft in there. How do you handle those? They are fairy tales in the Grimm collection. They're much shorter, and there aren't any birds flying around as there are in the movie. Witchcraft and sorcery shows up a lot in fairy tales. We need to be careful with it. Obviously, it can be a divisive issue in our schools. We need to respect the parent's authority. But in general, if you haven't read Lewis's English Literature in the 16th Century, I recommend you do, and try to read what Lewis says about magic. Magic and science develop at the same time in the Renaissance, not in the Middle Ages. The reason that science wins out is because it actually works, right? It's actually a way of understanding the world and working with it. In general, most fairy tales, the witches are bad. They're evil, right? And that's consistent with the moral universe. There are witches in the Bible, too, right? And I don't think you should just dismiss a story because it has a witch in it, right? What we have to be more careful with are wizards like Gandalf, right, who has magic, but he's obviously not bad. So we have to work through that with some discernment. But in general, I would, if you have a story with a witch in it, I would, especially at the elementary level, I would point out to parents that this is bad. The wicked witch, Snow White's stepmother, is obviously the villain in the story, and she's defeated, which is exactly what we want. So, other questions? Yes, in the back. Yeah, I knew this was going to be asked. Harry Potter. Oh, look at the time. Okay, here's my take on Harry Potter very quickly. Not the best written literature, especially the longer books. They're very episodic, and the episodes don't go anywhere. There's not so much character development. If you have students who are in love with Harry Potter, try to get Tolkien's Lord of the Rings in their hand. I had one student recently tell me, I read Harry Potter, the entire series, 3 times this year. But he hasn't even cracked Tolkien yet. Okay? The Harry Potter series, if you read it carefully and you're familiar with medieval literature and medieval tropes and symbolism, J.K. Rowling is borrowing very heavily from medieval symbolism and medieval literature. It's very much there. Hogwarts... If you think about what we said for fairy tales, Hogwarts is a secondary world. It's a world that is familiar and yet strange, and the whole purpose of the fairy tale is sanctification. Okay, so Hogwarts is a moral universe as well. There's good and evil. Those lines aren't always as clear as they should be according to biblical standards, but it's there. I have far fewer concerns with my students reading Hogwarts than I do with the Hunger Games trilogy, which is very much not a moral universe. So, and if you want to punch me in the head after this, you can come talk to me about that afterward. Thank you very much. I hope you have a safe trip home.